technical debt is a global infrastructure problem that plays out in business and government and all types of organizations. And our guest, Quinn Norton, explains a cause of so many of our big environmental errors in her article at emptywheel.net titled A World We Built to Burn. She describes recent wildfires in California as a story of disrespect and exploitation of the land, of failures of capitalism, regulation, and political will, of people who don't want to live with the consequences of their decisions, and people who have to live with the consequences of other people's decisions. And this is like so many of the stories that we talk about on this program. As I'm prone to do, I'd like to dive into solutions with you, Quinn. But first, we should explore the concept of technical debt a little further to understand how this is a challenge of shifting from investment rather than the debt that we've been building up.
So technical debt is a term that comes out of the software world, and essentially it's when you do something fast and dirty, or you do something halfway that gets the job done, but with the consequence that at some point you're going to have to go back and fix that in the future. It's a way of framing how the infrastructure we've been building isn't adequate to our needs and adequate to the planet's needs. So every time we build a piece of infrastructure, a dam, a new power line, a coal-fired power plant, planting invasive species, as happened extensively in California, we're not just kind of making a momentary decision. We're creating more technical debt that someone at some point is going to have to spend all the time and money and resources to fix so that you've got a piece of infrastructure and a piece of society that works in the environment that it's in. Technical debt is that moment when you put the TV on a stack of 16 books instead of buying a table for it to be on. And you know that's a bad idea, but you're just thinking, I'm going to deal with it later. And it's one thing when it's a television in your house. It's another when it's the infrastructure that feeds your television its energy.
Really, it's a constant thing that we recognize once we recognize the name for it. And yeah, there's just so many examples of how we're not paying up, realize later that we've got a lot of interest that we have to deal with.
I think it's really hard to think in these major systems, kind of give humanity an excuse here. I think it's really, you've got so much complexity going on, and I think it's really difficult to coordinate when talking about global systems, especially when you don't know that's the project. An example is just watching people figure out how to coordinate a global internet. Well, we do it every day, but it has all these crazy flaws and edge conditions nobody really thought of. And it means that the people who are doing this project of keeping the internet going have to start thinking in a very different mode than they were thinking in 5, 10, or 20 years ago. They're coordinating with people all over the world in a way that they didn't used to have to. It's not just the internet. There's a lot of global infrastructure that's starting to be that way. And I think that's a really good sign that people who are specialists, people who are doing shipping, people who are doing satellite work, all these different things, they're thinking much more in global terms than national terms. We need to be working on a planetary level on these issues. And that's a different way of thinking.
Well, and it's a different way of governing or, working. We don't have the systems, the political systems to do all that just yet. The city of Kansas City is currently working on using only renewable energy for their municipal buildings. So by the end of 2020 is the goal. And so they're working with the current energy company. Going to be something where they definitely want to put in the right investments in terms of technical expertise so that they don't get into any kind of, short-sighted thinking just to get something accomplished.
Knock that off the to-do list.
Right, and claim something that may or may not be valid or may not be in the best interest of the people or clean air. A lot of people are saying we're going to reach these goals, and I think those goals are super important, but at the same time, it's a matter of getting the steps.
It's not a very systemic way to think about it. One of the things that's an interesting case in California is that the state sets PG&E's priorities, and the main priority they've set for PG&E is decarbonization, is renewable energy. However, that means that the priority is not safety on the electrical lines. You know, we always make the joke, you've got to walk and chew gum at the same time. But this is walking and chewing gum and juggling chainsaws and learning how to walk on a pogo stick. Or
yeah.
This is walking, chewing gum, juggling chainsaws while on fire.
Literally. Yeah, it's hard to know who to bring in on these things. One example we talk about on this show a lot is the absence of systemic research in different kinds of scientific solutions to things like genetically modified crops, along with the pesticides that have been bred to resist them. You've got this great mm-hmm. expertise and technical innovation in one area, and then complete ignorance about the ecosystem. You're kind of pulling the spotlight away from the whole system that we right. need to continue to live off of, and instead just saying, look at this cool thing that we've done here in this part of the system, you know, that's solving this one problem.
Right.
People who are genetic engineers, they don't know ecology. You know, they're not the people to talk to about that. You have to get teams of people working together.
And this is where the concept of systems thinking comes in really handy, is like when you have both in the education, because we've gone, you know, since the Enlightenment, we've gone more and more towards extremely specialized thinking. And we're in a situation now where we need more systemic thinking. That doesn't mean people shouldn't specialize. They absolutely should. But it should be in a framework where there's other people who are kind of making the connections, who are talking to everyone from local inhabitants, indigenous populations, up to, you know, in the case of somewhere like California, the bankruptcy lawyers, or in the case of say, France, the elder care workers. This is a huge range of people. And I guess one of the things we need is somebody whose job it is to just kind of sit there and think of everybody who needs to be talked to, like a case manager. We need a lot of case managers and possibly therapists for climate change and planetary management.
At all levels of decision making, yeah. So a solution could be to develop more coalitions of experts from a wide range of fields, and to get people trained to find those experts, to know what questions to ask.
Right. And I think actually part of it is going to be, and you see this happening a little bit in academia, is kind of breaking a little bit out of the silos and cross-connecting better than we have. This is definitely a cross-connected problem, and it's going to need cross-connected solutions. So we're breaking down these silos, but it's slow going.
Yeah. In my little silo, I'm a high school science teacher, and I know this is something that's been a big drive in education recently, working on a project-based learning and working with multiple disciplines to come together and
right.
do cross-curricular work, and understanding that there's not, you know, just this one content area or this one study. You know, you have to bring people together to solve problems. So it's something that, you know, educators are trying to address, I know, and I think colleges are doing a good job with that. I know it, our nearest big university here, Kansas University, their engineering program is very multidisciplinary and does a lot of problem solving. And so I think it's going in the right direction.
I mean, this is the story of the 21st century, is we suddenly realize we need a lot very quickly, which is also like, that's what happens with technical debt, is one day you realize you need everything finished now.
Yeah.
You need to rewrite everything from scratch today.
You brought up the Y2K problem. I think that's a really great example. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So the classic example of technical debt people know about is the Y2K problem. And the basic version of the Y2K problem is that dates in the 20th century were coded with two numbers, because that's all you really needed. Like, what year was I born? 73. Nobody is going to be confused about the 73 of which century. So when people were engineering those systems, they didn't think they'd be in place. You know, if they were doing it in the 70s, they didn't think that system would still be in place in the year 2000, when they would need those other two digits. Computers need to know what time it is. So running up to Y2K, we realized a lot of computers were going to stop working all at once as soon as those numbers flipped over, and they all thought it was 1900. And that could have been an utter disaster. This is the thing. People are like, oh, it was overblown. It wasn't that big a deal. It was that big a deal. But it's actually one of those moments where humanity pulled together and a huge amount of workers' hours and a huge amount of thinking went into replacing these systems in a hurry so that planes didn't fall out of the sky and things didn't catch fire. And it worked. A few things failed, but for the most part, we managed to get past that by just the heavy lift of paying down all the technical debt in a matter of a few years. This problem of pulling together and solving a thing as it comes up, I mean, we kind of do that all the time. We do that when there's like a huge disaster and we need to go up and shore up the levees somewhere. But it's much better to do it beforehand than afterwards. And actually, this kind of gets into one of the problems of doing good infrastructure, whether it's in software or physical infrastructure, is that when you succeed, it's the dog that didn't bark. If you're like, this is a really big deal, we need to deal with it, and then you deal with it and you fix the problem, people are like, well, it wasn't that big a problem. Nothing bad happened. I would rather have that. I would rather have a lot of people complaining that climate change was blown out of proportion because we fixed it. Like, the other example of where we pulled together and fixed it is the ozone hole. You know, I had somebody come to me not that long ago and say, why does nobody ever talk about the ozone hole problem anymore? Wasn't that a real problem? And I said, yes, it was. And they created something called the Montreal Convention. The world got together and there were a lot of meetings. They were very boring meetings about chemical pollutants. And they came up with some standards. They figured out how to enforce them. They worked with every country on Earth. And they fixed the problem. So the ozone layer is healthy because we did that. We can do that. We can do it across boundaries. We can do it across cultures. We've got these great models for how we did it. But it's also realizing that's the problem.
Yeah, and getting those people from the areas that we need them to figure that out. I'm wondering, just because a lot of the initiatives that are relevant to environmental issues also involve groups of people getting together to solve problems of awareness. You know, I know you've worked with different kinds of organizations and different networks. And so do you see technical debt also being an issue in terms of building awareness or towards some kind of social change?
The biggest technical debt and awareness is in your field / my old field. The biggest technical debt we have in awareness is just that our educational systems have in no way caught up with our situation. That when it comes to these complex interlocking systems in the natural world, I spend most of my time writing about the computer world, and education hasn't even caught up with that. Like, we're not teaching how computers work, which is an absolute pet peeve of mine. People don't like it when I say the answer to all these things is revamping the education system, because that looks overly hard and overly slow. One of the things I like to point out is that if you look over, loosely, the 20th century, we flipped the 80-20 on literacy. We went from 20% literacy to 80% literacy at the same time that we went from 2 billion to 7 billion people. So that's an amazing lift. That is an amazing thing humanity did. We should all pat ourselves on the back for that. But I think it also means we're on the hook because we know we can do that. And nothing we need to learn right now, not climate issues, not sustainability issues, not digital literacy, not media literacy, not even the political literacy, none of that is as complex as learning to read and write. So it gives me a lot of hope that if we get serious about revamping education, then I think if we pick up that project, it's going to help with a lot of these other projects, getting more comprehensive about education. If there is something that prevents us from making it through this, I don't think it's going to be the politics. I don't think it's going to be right-wing authoritarianism. I don't even think it's going to be climate change. It's going to be neglecting education. And I'm not just saying that because you're a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like not only people in schools working to learn more practical things and learn ways that they can solve problems together from different disciplines, but also actually doing problem solving instead of just pretending. There's so much, we have people who are totally capable. I mean, I've worked with kids for years, and kids are as capable as adults at doing most of the things that adults do. And then people talk about child labor or something, but we're not talking about the problem with putting kids in mines is that there were mines. And that was a dangerous thing that nobody should have been doing. The problem wasn't that it was kids, it was unethical to put an adult in there too, you know. And I don't have a problem with kids doing work if they're
I don't
learning
think
and
there's a
they're.
serious ethics problems with getting children involved with citizen science, as an
Yeah,
example. I think
exactly.
getting more kids involved with citizen science and getting them involved with consequential projects that are connected to global effects, either because they think it's bad for the kids or bad for the projects. But I think we're leaving a huge amount of talent. You know, one of the biggest problems, I think, with how we are dealing with children at this moment is that we kind of treat them as inconsequential in their actions.
Well, and creating this world of like, okay, we're gonna kind of waste our time now or do whatever things that are may or may not be meaningful now, and then later you're gonna do the important stuff. And creating this kind of dichotomous, like, you know, kid world, adult world, putting everything off. And that concept of putting things off till a later date is silly. You know, they should be doing things too. And they are doing things. They have an impact on the world.
Nothing you do is meaningful except for the day when we throw you out, when everything you do is meaningful.
I saw kind of as an offshoot of one of the articles that was on Empty Wheel that got me thinking about other things I'd been reading. Howard Odum is an ecologist, and H.T. Odum, and he's created this concept of EMERGY, which is an environmental accounting system, as a way to assess environmental impacts along with human resources for a project. And then there's also this concept of the circular economy. Like the Ellen MacArthur Foundation has this drive to increase awareness of the circular economy and assessing things that way, where life cycles of materials and systems are considered solutions that are really, you know, involve a lot of different scientists and people with different technical expertise. Have you seen any efforts to actually put those into action?
One of the places where, and I again, nerdy, I love the scientists, I love the engineers, but one of the places where it falls down is not having an ethical framework for dealing with communities and getting input from communities. And that can mean so many things in different places. And I have a friend who works a lot on this and is actually writing a book right now, Debbie Chacha out of Boston. This idea of bringing in more community voices, that the scientist and the technician's voices are not the apex voices. They are part of a continuum, that everybody in the room is bringing something of value, and the technocrat doesn't get to overrule someone else. You know, one of the examples that's come up recently is taking in local knowledge from communities that have been in spot for a long time. And that's both indigenous communities and transplanted communities who've been dealing with things for longer than the technocrats have and the engineers have in a different way than indigenous populations. Like, how do we get everybody into a useful conversation? Sometimes that's socially and politically really difficult, but figuring out how to kind of get all the information together is how you build a system that is equitable and effective. People really often see effectiveness as either under or over the social and political aspects of things, but a solution that is technically efficient but has no community consciousness is engineered to fail. It's to go back to a metaphor from my software world. If you engineer the perfect piece of software, no one can use it because you don't have an interface that's usable by a human being. You've failed, and that all that work is wasted. I don't care how beautiful your code is. You can't fix a problem that interfaces with people without building something that interfaces with people. And that's true whether you're talking about a smartphone or a dam. Or, you know, or building new housing or managing river watersheds. All of that has interface, and that interface needs to be taken into account if the project is going to be successful.
AP design program at K-State, another Kansas university. They've been working with people in the community where I teach, which is in urban community of Kansas City, Kansas. And they've been creating these design charrettes of community members. And
what's
in particular,
a charrette?
It's kind of a popular term right now in design and architecture. And it's where you get people together from different areas and they try to solve this problem together. So it's like a design team, but it's like a multidisciplinary design team. And not just disciplines, but also people from the community. This design charrette was the grad students and some undergrad students and professors and teachers and students talking about how to solve problems at the design of a school. You know, that's a really good way to integrate the community into problem solving and to figure out how to avoid technical debt, you know, that later recognizing or realizing that, you know, you created this building, but nobody understands how to use it or nobody's using it. That's really the problem with our building originally, is that it was this kind of hilarious open classroom concept that I think is, I'm all for it, but nobody else was back in 1973 when it started, because it was just not, people weren't trained to teach in an open classroom. So they were trained to teach in their silos of English and math, and they didn't know how to work across disciplines back then, and nobody was telling them how to do it. But the designers who created the building were like, this is great. This is going to be the coolest building. And now they've had to create classrooms over the past 40 years, you know, in the building to solve that. There's also sustainability teams at a lot of different businesses and school districts and cities. And so that, I think that's a really good opportunity to get people from different areas of expertise to come together to solve problems.
I think one of the things you have to be very aware of when you're building these teams is who's not in the room. And this goes back to kind of traditional forms of power and disenfranchised communities, which people don't think of normally as an engineering issue, but it totally is. Like, if you walk into a room and you think about, does this room reflect the community, the wider community? Does it reflect the world in some significant way? Who's missing? You know, if you don't know who's missing, you don't know where your problem is going to come from. Because it's probably not going to, if you've got great experts in the room, it's probably not going to come from them. Even if you have the most brilliant people who will definitely not bring any problems into your system, that means all the problems are going to come from the people that you didn't get into the room before you started. And that can be issues of class, it can be issues of color and gender and religion and all these different communities, immigrant communities, so on and so forth. Like, if you don't have them as part of the conversation, they can't tell you the thing you're going to be dealing with 5 years from now. And that's what you want.
Yeah.
You want them to say, oh, no. I know where that water is coming out because it's near my low-income house.
Yeah.
I know what's going to happen if you do what you're about to do. You know, inclusion isn't just a really nice word. Inclusion is actually how you get the right thing done. It's as important to include marginalized people as it is to include math. Because math can't predict the things that your community can predict. And the people most likely to not be in the room are the marginalized people who tend to be closer to where things are going to go wrong. Stats can't figure out what's the best thing to do next. They can't figure out what you want. They can't figure out what you're trying to achieve. We are, as far as I know, really far from a computer that can actually tell you what we want to accomplish in the world.
Ecosystems, for example, you know, they can, we could use stats to analyze small aspects of an ecosystem.
Like, we can use stats, we can use computers to analyze a huge number of small things about an ecosystem. And that's, we're not going to make it as a civilization if we don't do that. But what we can't do, what we can't have our computers do, is decide what trade-offs we want to make. Where do we want to try and protect a community from the encroachment of the sea? And where do we want to relocate a community? You know, data is only as good as its inputs. And then at the end, it has to be contextualized by someone, which is always a political process. And we see that in cases like weather, where people are making political choices about how and when to evacuate or how and when to allocate resources based on weather data. That data is either accurate or inaccurate. It doesn't tell you whether to evacuate. That's policy. That's politics.
What we need people to do is go from a narrow mindset into a more systems thinking mindset. It's something, yes, that some of us understand more than others. How do we help people become systems thinkers? What's a way that we could do that, I wonder?
Well, I think going back to the original idea of a liberal education as it was once conceived is really, really key here. We right now, we think that we get education so that we can go get jobs. But the original idea behind a liberal education was an education that made you good at thinking, that made you good at ideas, and made you understand where things came from. And, you know, that kind of liberal education was at one point reserved just for the rich. But now we're in a situation where we really need everyone to have those skills. So going back to that idea of a rich liberal education that isn't about whether or not you're going to be able to get a job after college, that should be the last part of your decision making when it comes to what an education means. And one of the things that's been incredibly useful for me was breaking out of my very sciencey, very nerdy based area and going and looking at things like the history of whiteness in America. Going and looking at completely unrelated things, either because even climate issues are more in my wheelhouse than many of the social issues. But looking at the social issues helped me understand the other issues I was looking at much better than I did before. So just if we make it a cultural norm that people go outside of their specialization and spend some time looking at and doing things that they're not good at and learn enough to integrate that back in, they'll have more of a sense of those wider perspectives. And when they hit those wider perspectives elsewhere, they're going to know what they're seeing. Yeah, yeah, I'm a big fan of lifelong learning.
Yeah.
One of the problems with talking about climate change in some ways is that it's a very passive phrase and it's a very specific focus. Climate change isn't the same as plastic pollution, which isn't the same as water management. What I think binds them all together is kind of that we have to manage our planet. So when I think about like planetary management is an active thing that we need to do in response to things like climate change. When it comes to kind of managing a project, like there's a lot of fantastic language around managing projects from engineering and software development and those sorts of arenas where people are continually trying to kind of get complex systems to interact well together.
You're a good person to be thinking about that. You've been working with lots of different complex groupings of people, you know, people who are working around the world on networks and different kinds of web-based communities. And so you've seen,
yes,
how people do come together from different groups and create different kinds of solutions or create different sorts of projects together. So
sometimes different sorts of problems. I mean, there's a ton of difficulty and failure anytime you're dealing with complex systems. And that kind of has to be built into the process, understanding that there's going to be these kinds of setbacks and that when you encounter them, you factor them in, you continue on.